The International Mastermind Association is a group of like-minded individuals who have come together based on the mastermind concept espoused in Napoleon Hill's book, Think and Grow Rich. As masterminders, we commit to coming together as a group on a regular basis for a coordination of knowledge and effort in a spirit of harmony between two or more people for the attainment of a definite purpose. We come together to share knowledge with one another, support each other in setting and achieving our goals, and hold one another accountable to what we commit to do for ourselves. We set goals in 10 areas of our lives: spiritual, family, health, financial, business, civic, personal, educational, recreational, creativity. You must have goals and plans if you are going to succeed in any endeavor. After all, successful people have plans. Napoleon Hill said, quote, education, knowledge, and influence are more powerful than any exchange of money, end quote. For more information about International Mastermind Association, visit us on the web, internationalmasterminders.com, or once again, Facebook the group, International Mastermind Association.
And good morning. This is Ann McNeil, the Master Builder, helping you to build stronger and better lives and businesses. And I am extremely excited today because we have one of my favorite, yes, John, you are one of my favorite. Yes, you're one of my favorite NSA speakers because we remember when. But today we're talking about the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, Chapter 7 on Decision. It's also called The Mastery of Procrastination, The Seventh Step to Riches. And if you are joining us for the very first time, the book Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill was created out of a desire and a decision made by Andrew Carnegie to create a process that would help individuals learn the success principles that enable those who are born with nothing, if you will, and become something, if you will. But what are the steps? What are the processes? What are the systems? What is that philosophy of success? And as a result of that, he asked Napoleon Hill if he would be willing to take 20 years of his life and do the research for free. Carnegie said, I will only give you a list of the individuals that you would interview and cover your travel. So my question to each of you today that's listening to this program, what decision would you make in deciding if you would be willing to invest 20 years of your life to study the philosophy of success or personal achievement and be willing to take it to the world, but do it for free? I think the opposite of that decision is what happens to so many of us. We don't make the decision to study the philosophy of success. And so with that thought in mind, our flow for the show today is our awesome guest will come on the next half of the show. But our awesome co-host will come on, and each of us will share our aha moment from this chapter. With that thought in mind, I'll go ahead and share my aha moment. As I reread this chapter on decision, what jumped out at me was the fact that even though Napoleon Hill took 20 years to do this process, I personally made a decision in 1979, unknowingly, to dedicate my life to this philosophy of success, but for my own life. And as I began to do that and rereading and then beginning again to make the decision to implement what I'm reading, my life began to change. And by my life changing, the decision of many individuals around me, their lives began to change. On page 150, the aha moment for me says, I'm going to read, Keep your own counsel when you begin to put into practice the principles described in this book. By reaching your own decisions and following them, take no one into your confidence except the members of your mastermind group. And be very sure in your selection of this group that you choose only those who will be in complete sympathy and harmony with your purpose. Close friends and relatives, while not meaning to do so, often handicap one through opinions and sometimes through ridicule, which is meant to be humorous. Thousands of men and women carry inferiority complexes with them all through life, and because some well-meaning but ignorant person destroyed their confidence through opinions or ridicule. And so that was my aha moment in the rereading of this book and this chapter, and just thinking about the decisions that I have made. But more importantly, and I was sharing with some of our co-hosts before the show started, in the reread of this chapter, I am really beginning to reassess some decisions I need to make and some decisions that I have made that I'm now starting to really reflect on and the impact that they have had. So I'm going to go to our awesome co-host, but I'm going to ask each of you that's listening to this audio recording at any point in time and at any point in your life, I'm going to challenge each of us to ask ourselves the question, what decision do you need to make right now as you listen to this show? So I'm going to start off with our co-host, Mr. Galen. If you are anywhere near Galen Bingham and you have the opportunity to listen to him any way possible, whether it's audio, whether it's a keynote, or whether it's a workshop, he has one of those commanding personalities. Good morning, Galen. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you so much for the introduction, Ms. Ann. This is Galen Bingham, the leadership strategist. I help leaders crush their most important development goals. And I am really, really excited about not only the topic, but the guest. The first time I met John Register was my introduction to Black NSA. And not knowing anyone, I was looking for a friendly face, and I found one, sat down next to him, started having a conversation, and just really, really delightful conversation. And then afterwards, I Googled him and found out about all the things that he had accomplished, all the things that he was doing, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, I've met a superstar. So great to have that conversation with him. My aha from this chapter on decision making really comes from two things. Number one, just the meaning, the Latin root of to make a decision literally means to cut off all other options. And when I think about that in context with Think and Grow Rich, also on page 150, it says the majority of people who fail to accumulate money sufficient for their needs are in general easily influenced by the opinions of others. And the question then becomes, who are you allowing to influence you? And are they very consistent with what you said, Ms. Ann? Are they the right people to be influencing you? Or do they have sympathy for what you're trying to accomplish? Do they intentionally or unintentionally encourage you to achieve the goals that you've set for yourself? Or should you be listening more intently to other people or making your own decision, keeping your own counsel, reading books, watching videos that will, in fact, encourage you? So I'm really, really excited about this chapter, about this conversation, about this guest. I can't wait to get in. If you are listening and you've got friends, you've got relatives, you've got anyone that you believe would benefit from hearing this conversation, you have my permission to take the next 15 seconds to text a link, to call someone, because I think everyone needs to be part of this conversation. Thanks for having me on the show.
Always, always, always. And then there is Miss Ursula Odom. the owner of Sulu 2, we make old things new. Morning, Ursula.
Good morning. Thank you so very much. I love hearing you say that because that means that it resonates with you. We do make everything that we come across new by taking old information and sharing it with new audiences in a new way in every form we can, from books to documentaries to live performances. We make old new again. So my aha moment today is a decision, because I realized when I read page 153 that even in the midst of something so absolutely wonderful, Think and Grow Rich, this book is just truly amazing. It's transforming lives, including my own. I found something that I was not happy with. And with us celebrating the 4th of July and our independence as a country, I realized when I read the statement, the story begins with an incident in Boston. That summed up one person's life that wasn't even mentioned. Most people that were associated with it, they told the story, they said what decision that person had to make in order to make this country free, the choices that they had to consider, how life and death they were. And I said, one person's life was summed up with a statement that said, the story begins with an incident. And that person's life was Crispus Attucks. He was an African-American of African and Indian descent that was the first person to die for the American Revolution. And his name is not there. So what that said to me as my aha is that even in the midst of greatness, your life, your story is still something that's your own responsibility, or people that care about you. His story is told by the people that knew it, that cared about him, that knows that it's important to this country. And that is what I say to each and every one of us. The things that we do, the things that people do around you that are too shy to talk about is what we need to capture, because people need to know about them, because we learn from them and we grow from them. This man's life affected an entire nation, an entire world, and his name is not there, but his spirit is. That's my aha for today.
Wow. That is an aha. That is an aha. And I thank you both for sharing. And I really want to go ahead and I'm so excited about having John on. We have a lot to talk about. John, I want to just share with our listeners that you, in my opinion, are one of the most giving individuals, as you stay in touch with all of us at different levels and at different times. So right now we're going to go to a commercial break as we talk about many of the chapters that we've covered in the past, in terms of we walk through this book every single Saturday. Each month we walk through a chapter at a time, and we're going to listen to a review of what the chapters are. Then we'll go to a commercial, and then we'll come back with our special guest, John Register.
Number one is desire. Napoleon Hill says that everything starts with a burning desire, a compelling reason for doing what it is we do. Step two is faith, having belief in our ability to attain that which we desire. Step three is what he calls auto-suggestion. Auto-suggestion simply means being very intentional about the things that we are pouring into our thoughts, into our brains, and into our consciousness. Our brains, our minds will receive everything automatically, but we have to work extra hard to make sure that the positive things are what we are feeding ourselves, because that positive thoughts are going to turn into positive actions. Step number four is specialized knowledge. No one person knows everything even about whatever their particular area of expertise might be. And the value of the mastermind principle is using the specialized knowledge of other people, imagination, the workshop of the mind. Everything starts with our imagination and our thoughts, the burning desire to transform those thoughts into our reality. In order to do that, we have to look at step six, which is organized planning. That is how we crystallize our desire into action, organizing ourselves. Having the thought and not acting on the thought isn't going to get us anywhere. We have the thought. We go through the organized planning to transform that thought into action. Step number seven is decision, which Napoleon Hill says is the mastery of procrastination. Napoleon Hill says that the antidote to procrastination is simply to make a decision and then move on that decision. Step eight is persistence. We have to have a sustained effort, which is induced by our faith, in order to achieve our goals. One of Napoleon Hill's books, I love even the title, 3 Feet from Goals, that those people who became rich during the gold rush in the Wild Wild West days didn't do that because they were necessarily smarter or had better information than anybody else. It's because they stayed just a little bit longer. Sometimes people left when they were just literally 3 feet from gold. So hanging in there, being persistent, is step number eight. Step number nine, the power of the mastermind, the driving force. None of us can accomplish anything on our own. Everybody, I don't care who you are, from the most prominent person to the person who might be considered the lowest on the totem pole, everybody had somebody who helped them to get to where they are. And the power of the mastermind is being able to use those influences around us, use the thought, use the knowledge, use the inspiration of other people to help us in achieving our goals. Step number 10, the mystery of sex transmutation. This title can be a little confusing, but essentially what the mystery of sex transmutation means is that we oftentimes in our society think of sex as being purely physical. It is absolutely physical. But what Napoleon Hill teaches us is that sex also has an emotional element, and that sex is the strongest of our desires. That if we can take our sexual energy, transform that into positive, creative influences, it can propel us to new heights. And so we spent quite a bit of time talking about the mystery of sex, of step 10, which is sex transmutation. 11 is the subconscious mind, which Napoleon Hill tells us is the connecting link between our human mind and the infinite intelligence, the source of all thought, the source of all creativity. Conscious mind, we spent some time talking about how we use that through the influence of auto-suggestion and what we're feeding into our minds. Step number 12, which is the brain, the broadcasting and receiving station of thought.
And we are back. Today's show, we are honored to have, I'm calling you my friend, John Register, who is advising two U.S. Secretaries of State. He's been featured on numerous television shows, and honestly, I can go on and on. What I remember most about John is, really, John, for me, you're the first person that I heard talk about the new normal. So I would welcome you on the show. We're going to have a lot of conversation about some questions about the chapter, but also what you're doing that's impacting the lives, not just of thousands, but I would suggest millions of individuals who are experiencing a new normal in their lives. To talk a little bit more about John, we're going to do that as the show goes on, but I would encourage everybody to go to johnregister.com. John is a four-time track and field All-American and a two-time Olympic trials qualifier who suffered a sports opportunity for growth. And so that's my repurposing your story, John. And so we want to welcome you. We want to welcome you on this show, and really encourage all of our listeners to just take a moment and maybe settle down for a couple of minutes and participate in the show. If you want to ask a question or you want to make a comment, just press 1 on your phone. And we'll invite you in, but I want to introduce to all of you my friend John Register. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I am so excited to be here, and what an amazing opportunity and gift that you have given. I want to tell you all, Anne is like one of these individuals I have to call very sparingly, because when I do, I know she's going to say the first thing. I said, "Hey, Anne, I was just thinking about you." Anne's going to say, "I know you were. I know you were, and this is why you called me." And I'm like, what? You always, always are pushing in those directions. Oh, my gosh. I love you. You are just one of those amazing individuals, and thank you so much for having me on.
Well, what I'd like to do is to start off, John, as opposed to reading a long bio, if you can share with us a little bit about your story. We're going to get into the questions and the dialogue and all of that. But I think it's very important as we start the show that we hear from your mouth to our ears and your heart to our heart and hand and head, your story and how did you get to this point in your career. And also we'll talk about how did you come upon this book? And then we'll later talk about our Black NSA experience.
Yeah,
so
thanks. It's interesting, you know, how life takes, you know, various twists and turns, and sometimes we may be cognizant of it, and sometimes it just kind of takes us by storm that we become into awareness afterwards. For me, I was, like you said in the introduction, a four-time All-American at Arkansas, ran for the Razorbacks, you know, had some success there, wound up after graduating with a degree in communications, I decided to enlist in the United States Army because I wanted to continue to run track and field. And so I went to two Olympic trials, once with the United States Army, once kind of in between college and joining military service. And the reason I went into the Army, because they had this program called the Army's World Class Athlete Program, and allowed a soldier athlete to train 3 years prior to the next Olympic Games at that time. And the first coach I had in that is, his name is Charlie Green, Nebraska guy. He was on the 1968 Olympic team, gold medalist in the 4x100-meter relay, bronze medalist, and he was a major at the time in the United States Army. First coach, and his motto was, "You're soldier first, athlete second." And I really didn't understand all that until I had been selected for the Army's World Class Athlete Program and wound up having to divert my plans, to go and support the needs of the Army, the needs of our country, and fight in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And so I did that for 6 months, came back kind of without a scratch, and re-picked up where I left off. But I was, because of the time of 6 months away from practicing my craft, I wound up switching events from the 110-meter high hurdles, which is the shorter race of the sprint race, and I changed to a longer race of the 400-meter hurdles. And actually, it was a gift in disguise because I found my niche, I found my race. And after only five races, wound up being in the Olympic trials, and I said, "Well, shoot, if I can be in the Olympic trials and only five races on this, you know, where could I take this?" So I left and went to Germany, started training over there, was with another military unit at the same time, and was on my way, really on a trajectory of making the 1996 Olympic team. But in 1994, when I was back on temporary duty
with the All-Army Track and Field Program. I was training in Hays, Kansas. It was very windy that day. I misstepped a hurdle. I landed awkwardly, which caused my left leg to hyperextend. And the hyperextension, as I fell forward, it dislocated my knee to the point to where my artery behind the kneecap, the arterial flow, was blocking the blood flow to the lower portion of my left leg. It took, by eyewitness account, about 90 minutes for the ambulance to arrive, put me in the back, have the leg reduced or put back in place, and the doctor still wasn't getting a reading to the lower portion of my foot on my big toe. So I was life-flighted into Wesley Medical Center in Kansas, Wichita, Kansas, and I underwent an 11-hour vein graft operation and several other operations that were just, they worked sort of, but it just didn't work adequately enough to repair the damaged artery. So I wound up having a choice to make by Dr. Randy Mullins coming in with the family and saying, you know, you can keep your leg, use a walker or wheelchair for the rest of your life, or I can amputate your leg and you can, you know, use a prosthesis for the rest of your life. And so as I thought about that for the next about 15 seconds, it was the pain that really spoke first, because I said, you know what, if I could just get rid of this pain that I'm in, which was the most excruciating pain I've ever been in my life, to the point where I was running high blood pressure, fevers and everything. I said, I'll just, you know, I told the doctor, I know it has to be amputated. And that was really the decision that changed the rest of my life. All that stuff that led up to me, I know were moments to have me make a decision like that. But that decision was a critical moment in my life because it was mine. It wasn't my wife's choice, even though, you know, she was there and super supportive. My mother, my father, extremely supportive. My son, John Jr., really didn't, he's 5 years old. He didn't really know what was going on. But it was that choice that said, you know, I can get rid of this leg and get rid of this pain, not knowing what might be in the future. But I can pinpoint that choice, and there was another choice as well that came up a little bit after that. But that was the determining factor, one, that decision. And so because of that, a lot of things began to spin in motion, one of which was my wife, and Annie alluded to this, talking about the new normal, was in the lowest point of my moment of existence, I believe. I was really doubting who I was now. Am I still a husband? Will my wife still stay with me? Will my son, John Jr., still see me as his father? Do I still have a job in the Army? Can I support my family? Because my Olympic dreams are over. And all of those thoughts were hitting me like a flood. And my wife, Alice, when I was on the playground, parked in a wheelchair, inaccessible playground, so I couldn't move on the playground, she was playing with my son, John Jr., on the swing set. And I just lost it, started bawling, crying uncontrollably. And she came over and asked me what was wrong, and I started articulating to her all my fears. And then she said the words that really stopped my downward spiral. You know what, John, we're going to get through this together. It's just our new normal. And when she spoke those words, I kind of baselined and, you know, started kind of thinking a little more deep about it. Not so much in that one moment, but in the instance of, she wasn't about to leave. You know, we're going to be in this together. That's what I heard. And then John Jr. jumps off the swing set, comes running over at 5 years old, yelling at me and screaming, pointing back to the swing, saying, "Hey, Dad, you see my big jump, Dad? You see my big jump, Dad?" And he jumps in between Alice and myself, and I realized that he had just validated me as his father, and he had just created his new normal. And that's what I had to do. I had to make the decision to create a new normal of existence, where new is no prior point of reference and normal is the everyday typical of occurrence of a thought or idea or an action that we can make. So I wasn't going to no longer live in the past. I was going to live in the moment that I had right in front of me right now. I wasn't going to live in the future. I'm going to live in this moment that I have right in front of me right now. And it was the defining moment of solidifying that came with the white Bronco chase with O.J. Simpson. And I was in the most pain after the amputation that I'd ever been in my life. And I'm on my cousin's couch in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm just kind of fists are clenched. I'm kind of tapping the end of my stump because the amputation has happened now, and I'm just kind of holding on for dear life. And I see hear the reporter as the white Bronco chase is going down the I-5 in L.A., and you got all the police cars behind O.J. They're reading what appears to be a suicide note from him. I don't know if you all remember that. But as I was listening to that, I resolved in myself at that one moment that no matter how bad it got, no matter how bad the pain got, I was never going to write a letter like that, ever. And that became the solidification of the decision I'd made to amputate the leg. That there was a resolve that I would always push forward. I would always take the next step. There was always going to be the next day. And that began to kind of be that mantra that, you know, worked itself over and over again. So since that time, and I'll fast forward so we can get into the conversation. I really want to get into the conversation. So since that time, what happened was I started swimming for physical therapy because I really believe we in resilience have to do a couple things. One, in that moment was my silence. And embedded in the word resilience, I say in my presentations, is the word silence. So we got to hear our own voice first. We have to find our resolve. And from that, we can have a ritual. We develop a ritual. That ritual elevates us or pushes us to our rhythm. And that rhythm will elevate us to our rise. And so my rise in that piece was swimming for physical therapy, every day getting faster, getting stronger, and that resolve, that rhythm, that rise rose me to making not the Olympic team, but the Paralympic team for swimming. So I went from a 400-meter hurdler to on the Paralympic team in Atlanta, Georgia, on a parallel track as a swimmer. And the Paralympic Games, for those that don't know, are athletes with disabilities, have physical disabilities and visual impairments. It's often confused with Special Olympics, which is for cognitive disabilities. So Paralympics is physical, and it parallels, another Greek word, parallels, the Olympic Games. So you have the Olympic Games, and 2 weeks later, the Paralympic Games, or the parallel games to the Olympics. I never knew about this world. All because of the decision that I made, this whole other world opened up to me. So I began getting really smart and understanding the opportunities that people with disabilities actually have. Most of the time, it's viewed as obstacles. But I chose to not look at those things. I love the way you introduced me, Anne, as not looking at the obstacles, but looking at the opportunities that are in our lives. It's all in our minds and how we determine to look at things. And so from there, I saw people on the track running with artificial legs. I said, I got to get one of those things. Because why am I in the water? Why am I swimming? Why am I swimming? I'm not a swimmer. I made this team. I'm doing something great, but this is not my lane. My lane was I was doing track and field for 16, 18 years at the highest level, just almost making the Olympic team. Why am I in the swimming pool? So I had a leg made for running, and I knew in 4 years I would be on that medal stand in Sydney, Australia. Didn't know how I was going to get there. I hadn't taken my first step running, but I knew how to run. And I just had to figure out how to run with an artificial leg, and it was game over.
John,
I learned how to run.
You hadn't even taken your first step walking yet. Okay.
No.
Talk about running.
Oh, talk about running.
Well, listen, let me read something that came to me as you were talking. And it's actually on the first page of chapter 7 in the book. Think and Grow Rich, as toward the bottom. The author says, analysis of several hundred people who had accumulated fortunes well beyond the million-dollar mark disclosed the fact that every one of them had the habit of reaching decisions promptly. That's what you did when you made that decision to amputate. And changing these decisions slowly, if and when they were changed. People who fail to accumulate money without exception have the habit of reaching decisions, if at all, very slowly, and changing these decisions quickly and often. And John, I remember, I think we met the very first, I think we may have met the very first time you came to NSA. That's what I remember of you. And to have watched your growth in, what's it, 5 years maybe? How long have you been a part of the National Speakers Association?
I think 2012 was my first year. Yep, 2012.
Okay. A little over 5 years.
That was
years.
A decision within inside of itself.
Well, see, but I remember you telling me the story and how you got there that day. That's another story
yeah.
for another show. But,
right.
But the decision, you know, I wrote as you were talking, that decision, and the resilience and the ritual and the resolve and the rise. You know, it just helps us to really understand the power of a decision, but also the lack thereof. Now,
yeah.
I know that Galen and Ursula has some questions, so I'm going to go to Galen first. But while he's coming on, I just want to encourage all of us to just think about, you know, the fact that we pray and we talk about all these things we want to have. But are we really appreciative of the movement of our limbs we have, the breath, the eyes, all of these things we have? And oftentimes it's not until we have to make a decision like what John had to do that we really begin to have a greater appreciation for the gift of life, just the gift of life. Galen, I know you had a question or two.
Yeah, absolutely. Listening to John, I'm reminded of a couple of things, the two things from the book, but one personal experience. One of my first mentors is a guy by the name of Joe Cavalier, and he actually wrote the foreword to my book. And he once told me that there is a fine line between confidence and arrogance, and your job is to tap dance on that line. And as I listen to some of the things that you're talking about, John, you had to be stepping on that line between having confidence in your ability and then the arrogance to think, not only am I going to walk again, I'm going to be on the podium for being one of the fastest runners ever. And so that's just one thing that comes to mind as I hear your story. But my question has to do with another area of confidence meeting arrogance, and it's in the book on page 156 and 157. I want to get your impression of this, where they're talking about Samuel Adams as they were stepping into the Revolutionary War. He got this love letter from the governor of England saying, look, you need to calm down. I'll give you a little money if you can quiet all this revolutionary stuff. But if you don't take the money, if you don't calm down, let me remind you that I've got a hangman's noose with your name on it. And
right.
Samuel Adams' response was, "You need to tell the governor that it's my advice to him that he not mess with exasperated people, and that he needs to back down." So he had confidence, tap dancing on arrogance. But I think that came with his making a decision. And then the other example is on page 157, where Patrick Henry spoke boldly about his decision that being apart from England, having our own country, having our own independence was worth whatever risk. And one of the last lines of one of his famous speeches, he says, "If this be treason, then make the most of it." So if you can just react to those two parts of the book and how making a decision in your life has given you the not only the confidence, but some might even say arrogance, to think that you could not only be good, but you could be great at whatever decision you were making.
That's great. Thanks for that question, Galen. You know, here's what I think with this. Those gentlemen, you know, Sam Adams or Patrick Henry and the others, they had a resolve, and they had been fed up with being fed up. And at that time, when you look at, you know, kind of American history, and we talk about, you know, NFL players kneeling and all that stuff. The first kneelers were not NFL players. Think about how the first kneelers actually fought in the Revolutionary War. They knelt before their brothers and sisters that were over in England trying to keep them intact. And they fired weapons. That's how they fought. They fought in those rounds. And so they would kneel and fight and fire weapons to protect and raise the stretching of their democracy or their flag, in this case. And the resolve that they had was that, I don't know if I would call it arrogant. I know the fine line between arrogance, because I think that's another mindset, you know, that arrogance tends to say, I am better than you. And this is more saying, I am independent. I am resolved in my independence of you. I don't have to follow these rules. I don't think I'm better than you. I just think I want my own space and place. I don't want you dictating over me who you believe me to be. And I think that's where those two gentlemen are or were. And so for me in my life, it's been that same defiance of, you're not going to dictate to me who you believe me to be. So like in my speeches, I'll say I have three levels of what I call stigma that I had to overcome. The first level was the stigma of myself, you know, those fears I had with Alice and John Jr., Alice not seeing me being as my wife anymore, John Jr. may not see me as his dad. So I had to overcome that fear right there. So I had to rebuild on that fear. The second one, though, is where I think where we're talking about decision-making today, and that is overcoming the negative stigma of others. Other people believing for us what we can or cannot do, which is based upon what they believe they could or could not do if they were in our situation.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, right, that is the resolve. So once I have rebuilt, now I have to redefine. I'm now redefining myself, not for myself, but to my marketplace. And that's where they were. They were redefining themselves to King George and the others that were over there that had the hangman's noose for them, and saying that I've shifted. I'm over here now. I have moved to the left or the right, and you're still in the center. You need to catch up to where I am now, because I'm no longer this person that you think I am. And so I have found that over and over again. And that's why you can't share your vision, your dreams, your goals with everybody. Because if you have staked your claim and you are further down the road than other people can get to, you have to allow them to catch up, climb the mountain, and get to where you are. It's not that you're better than them. It's just that you've shifted. You've moved. When I talk to NBA players who are just going into the league for the first time, the hardest thing they have to do is release from the people that they've been around, because they can't get there. They're not there yet anymore. They're not with them anymore. So some of their boys that they've been hanging with are looking at them sideways now, because you think you're all that because you made the NBA. And they're trying to really – they struggle with that, because for a long time they may have gone with them to college or to high school and played AAU ball, and now they've made it and the other person has it, and they got this little bit of hatred going on, a little haterade. But I tell them, you have to be defined in who you are. Maybe you can go back and get them later on, but you need to have your mastermind or those five individuals that are going to pull you forward and be strong enough to pull you forward that you can reach back maybe and pull a couple with you. But you have to stake your claim and hold on to it. And that gets us into the release. Because the third thing is the cultural release is that cultural, societal, tries to dictate to us who we should be. Why did I have those fears in the first place? who had I listened to in society that made me think Alice was going to leave or John Jr. wouldn't see me as his dad? What was it that I heard? Was it Captain Hook? In a Walt Disney movie? The Cultural Society of Peter Pan? And Captain Hook's an amputee. He's the villain, so all villains are amputees. So now I'm an amputee, so therefore I see myself as the villain. Or the people down in Brooke Army Medical Center burned over 90% of their bodies. Do they see themselves to their families in the Nightmare on Elm Street because we had a movie talking about their Freddy Krueger now that burned people, are disfigured, they're horrified. We shouldn't be looking at them as people that are a part of our society, but people that we need to be afraid of. So cultural norms can change on a dime, and we see it with the morning tweets that go out from the White House. CNN goes one way, Fox goes another way, and we change on the tweet. So can we, and I'm not saying right or wrong, I'm saying can we put a stake in the ground on who we are based on how we rebuilt, how we redefined, and now we can release from the cultural norms that try to hold us to that. And that is a decision we have to make. And that's what the resolve was between Adams and Patrick Henry. And then, Ursula talked a little bit more about the one that's not even named that made the first decision of an African-American that was there and Native American, African-Native-American, in Christmas Attucks. So while these gentlemen are trying in this resolve to pull away from England, right, there's another resolve that's going on saying we're going to keep slavery in the Union. So that's crazy when you think about that, right? These two resolves, one for good and one kind of for evil, that were going on right at the same time.
Audience, now you are getting what I got in my first 15 seconds in the Black NSA organization. This, I mean, literally, I had no choice but to join. I had no choice but to get more of this after hearing this. And quite honestly, if you want to get more of this for yourself or your organization, you've got to find John Register online. You've got to book him, because not only do you need to have this as part of your life, you need to make sure that your organization hears this message. Thank you so much for sharing. You answered not only the question that I asked, but three more that I was planning to ask, so thank you for that.
Oh, boy. With that, we're going to move to Ursula, because I am writing and writing, and I am loving this. Ursula, you're up.
Oh, my goodness. All of the things that have been going through my head during this conversation, I don't even know where to start. But I tell you what, I had planned to ask about redefining your mindset as it relates to a disability. And I think, quite frankly, you've defined that in a lot of different ways. But I want to tell a story a little bit that may spark you to think of something else. There's a friend of mine who was convinced that he was not smart because he had a difficult time in school. And you can tell him he was not smart. And then he was the type of person that if the sofa didn't align with the towels on the floor, I looked at his face and I got up and I straightened that sofa out, right? And he said, you know that bothered me, right? I said, yeah, I know. Well, that was kind of a disability, but that disability turned him into a master construction architect. And he built bridges and airports that were award-winning. And the decision that he made because of his disability was that he found someone in school, or someone in school, in college, found him and decided that he wanted to mentor him. And he decided, my friend decided, that he knew nothing. So he was just going to listen and do whatever this man told him to do. Well, he was being mentored by a master architect. And but you couldn't convince him that he wasn't a smart person. But if you wanted an onion to be peeled back and get down to the net of something, Lord have mercy, it was excruciating. He turned a disability into genius as far as I was concerned. So what is that mindset that once you get to that point, are you, I mean, where are you at this point? Who are you?
Well, that's a great question. I think going back to your friend, what's going on in my head is who's telling him he's disabled or he's not smart? Who is he allowed into his life to make him believe that so in-depthly into himself? Is it a school system? I'm not asking to answer the question, but I'm just saying, you know, all of us, the listeners that are out there, if we think that we have some type of deficiency in our lives, who's telling us that? Who are we believing in that moment? Because if you can pinpoint somebody in your life that's telling you that you are not capable of achieving something, that person needs to be what I call amputated out of your life. You have got to make the decision to amputate them right now. They might be able to come back in later, you know, put on a prosthetic or something. But right now, you got to get them out of your life because you need to hear positive voices that are telling you that you can actually achieve. Because this gentleman is actually truly amazingly smart and can find a niche in the world. And we talk about disabilities. Is that person really disabled, or are we placing a label on that individual based on what we believe we could or could not do if we were in that person's situation? So for me right now, what I have begun to understand even more about myself is the impact and being intentional about impacts that I think in the past I thought were serendipitous, that they were just coming. And I have been more intentional, especially with the Mastermind book and Think and Grow Rich, and that these are not serendipitous. It's not by happenstance that these things are happening. And so I can put myself in position to actually create these things that happen in my life. So these connections that come, whether it's I'm saying my affirmations. I know you all probably talked about affirmations before, but saying my affirmations in the morning or in the evening time, or what I call these echoes that come back in our lives. And so I want to be intentional about the echoes. So ripples go out from us, but ripples hit some type of resistance or some type of wall that brings them back on us, and those come back to us as echoes. So we yodel out, you know, we hear it come back to us into our ears. So think about dolphins or marine life. They use sonar echolocation to see where they are in their environment, in the water. But blind people do the same thing. When they're walking down the hallway and they wear hard shoes and they can hear the echo coming off of them to course correct them, so they know how large a space is or how small a space is based upon the echoes that come back. And they know what other things might be around them inside the room even. So they're using their ears to see. We also have that in our lives. So people will come into our lives that will give us those course corrections with an echo. So if you've ever said something to somebody and then all of a sudden it comes back to you by somebody else that you don't even know, and you know it's your words that person is giving back to you, that's an echo that comes back in its crass form, crassness. So where I am in space right now in my life is being intentional about creating those opportunities for other individuals. I love seeing people succeed. I love watching their growth and going from one place to another place and being so amazing in who they are that they are now creating echoes in their own lives and impacting so many people. That's what fuels me. That's what drives me. So I hope that answered your question, Ursula, on where I am right now in my space.
It does. And there was something else I wanted to ask, too. When you mentioned that things can turn on a dime, it reminded me of something else that happened for me personally. I am three generations of the name Ursula in our family, and it was a badge of pride, quite frankly, you know, the epitome of strength and gentle with those who treat you well because it means little she-bear. And then one day Disney came up with
Witch.
Here I am, yep. My grandmother and my daughter and myself attached to the name, and we had to regroup because I not only for myself, I had to deal with it with my child being young at that time. And it's like, oh no, somebody must have really ticked off somebody at Disney to have a real person's name as a sea witch. And so the media positions us to wake up one day and just totally be upended by something that happened on the news, somebody with our name, somebody with from our city. So being able to make a decision to get above that, I think, is a daily occurrence for most of us right now. Is that something that you've had to deal with at all in any way?
Yeah, I want to jump in on that, because that's the third level, right? That is the how I frame as the cultural norm. And so cultural norms can shift on a dime, but can you stake who you are and say, no, I'm not the sea witch. My name is Ursula, and this is what it means. I don't know what Disney's talking about, but this is who I am. And so that's the defiance of the decision that you make to be defiant in who you are. And so oftentimes we just will shift. If somebody says we're supposed to be this way, okay, that's what I guess I'm supposed to be that way. And we can't plant our flag because we don't know who we are. And that's a whole other this conversation. And so that's great that you understand and keep that name, keep it going. Be defined in that. If that's the, you know exactly what that means, you make them shift. Not to them make us shift. We make others shift.
And to that point, it means Little She Bear, and it's Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, you know, the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. It's the North
Dipper,
Star,
Dipper,
y'all.
Right. Right. And that's what you say, you know. That's how you change the vernacular of what somebody else is trying to define for you. Remember when slaves came to this country, one of the biggest things the slave owners wanted to do was strip them of their identity.
Right.
Other people trying to have control over another group. Your name is not going to be Kunta Kinte. Your name is Toby. We have to know who we are. And the reason that whole story of roots can come forward is because they kept passing the tradition and the name down through the generations, even though the other people are calling them something different.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Well, I am still writing. We have a lot of callers, and if you want to participate in this conversation, we're going to prepare to go to a commercial break, and we will take your questions and your calls. John, you are just phenomenal. We're going to prepare also to give our aha moments from what we've heard after we come back from the commercial break. But I just want to let everybody know, if you tuned in late, that we are talking today about the chapter on decision, the mastery of procrastination, the seventh step to riches. And our special guest today is actually very special. Yes, John, you're very special, because as a United States Paralympic long jump silver medalist, I want to go down to the part of your bio that talks about the fact that John enjoys pushing his patience as he coaches teenagers in track and field. And when you talk about a decision, and one of the things I wrote over and over and over, John, I think it was just so appropriate for you to be our guest today, on the chapter of decision, to open this chapter up with you is just the universe just nodding and smiling at us, because the decision that you made to become an amputee, I mean, how many of us would have made that decision? But, oh, my gosh, it is really a blessing in disguise for so many of us to learn from your story. So we're going to go to a commercial break. We will be right back, and we'll continue talking with our friend John Register.
For more information about the International Mastermind Association, visit internationalmasterminders.com, or on Facebook, visit the group International Mastermind Association. The name of the book is Think and Grow Rich, the original version restored and revised by Napoleon Hill. ISBN 593-302-0002. That ISBN number again, 1-593-302-0002.
All right, and we are back. And I want to remind our listeners and callers that if you want to participate in the program, just press 1. But I also want to go ahead and give my my aha moment. John, I have 2 pages, so I'm not going to listen, I can write a book on these chapters. Before I give my recap, though, I would like for you to share with our listeners, and we do have someone that just pressed that they'd have a question. So I'm going to go to her question first, and then I'm going to come back with mine that speaks to your Black NSA, which is a part of the National Speakers Association experience, and your thoughts about that, and how did you first come in contact with this book. So the caller, the last 4 digits of your number is 6757.
Good morning, Ann McNeil. This is morning. Lynn Whitfield.
Good morning, Lynn. Thank you for calling in.
Yes.
Good morning.
And I am so glad that I got the text today to join the show, and I came on just as Mr. Register was starting to talk with your introduction. And I'm out here taking my walk, and I'm going to give Ashley an aha moment. When he started talking about redefining who you are and not allowing others, and that others may have seen you in one place, but you can redefine yourself. As you know, Ann, 7 years ago, I was brain surgery, paralyzed on the left side, didn't know if I'd ever walk again. And then after I was able to, when the person that came for me, what he didn't realize was that that experience had helped me redefine myself and helped me to realize that I could overcome anything and that I was not going to be afraid of someone to threaten me, that I was going to stand because I knew I could make it through. And so that is just my aha moment from listening to him talk about how he overcame and how he took advantage of the opportunity that was given to him when he made that decision. And I'm just so thankful that I had an opportunity to hear him this morning. And that was my comment.
Well, thank you so very much for that, Lynn. And that's why I mentioned the front part of the show. You know, we have to each make a decision in our lives, but when you look at the lives that John is touching, have touched, and will touch, the question becomes for each and every one of us, and I'll make this personal to myself, what decisions do I need to make to impact the lives of others? Because what's happened with John Register and his spirit and desire to serve, God put him in a position to serve an entirely different set of individuals, but at the same time giving him one of the most honorable opportunities in which to do that and still do well by doing good and do good by doing well. So thank you so very much for your question, Lynn. And anybody else that would like to participate, please press 1 on your dial and we'll bring you in. I'm going to go ahead and give my ahas, and then we'll ask Galen to give his and Ursula to give hers. Mine naturally were all the R's, right, John? You know, the resilience, the resolve, mm-hmm. the rise, you know, the rebuild, the redefine, the relief, the reach back. And I'm going to add another one. And that brings me to the book. The other R that I'm going to add is to read. And in the mm-hmm. reading, can you share with us how did you first come in contact with this book and then also go into your experience with Black NSA? Then we'll go to Galen and then Ursula.
Yeah, I had heard about the book before, and somebody gave it to me. I don't remember who it was. You know, it was before Black NSA. And I just, you know, it was like on the shelf, and I started it and I was like, I'm not sure about this. This kind of seems kind of fluff and pie in the sky stuff. So I never really took a deep dive into it. And the fact that I thought it was just about making money, and I was so ignorant at that point. But with BNSA, you know, I joined the National Speakers Association in 2012. And the reason I joined was for really for two reasons. One, I was working for the United States Olympic Committee at that time, and I really wanted, my desire was to have vet some people that could actually teach Olympians and Paralympians how to tell their stories in a better way. I just saw, and I still see, there's a lack of storytelling in a movement that should all be all about storytelling. And I really have a burning desire to continue to do that. And I still coach some athletes right now in how to tell and share their stories in a better way, so they can actually make revenue and income from it. So that's what I was after. That was one thing. The second thing was I was about to get out of the speaking game myself, because I've been a speaker since '98. You know, somebody, I was at a terror mission, Total Army Involvement in Recruiting. I was doing the presentation, and the recruiters asked me to come back down there because the principals were saying, "Hey, these kids can't stop talking about this one-legged guy who did a speech for them." And it was like, it wasn't really a speech. It was more like an emceeing of some programs. And they asked me, "How much do you charge for that?" And I said, "You get paid to speak? I'll get back to you on that." And I started calling people, and they started telling me about the NSA. So when I got into NSA in 2012, I saw that there was a subcategory of black NSA in there. And I said, well, why is it this subcategory if we're all kind of just general speakers? And I found that there is a difference between of having a community that kind of understands your vernacular, your language, and some of the challenges that might be out there that we frame now as opportunities that might position you differently in the marketplace. And so I wanted to learn about that. And there were so many individuals, and yourself, and there's Dr. Willie Jolly and Les Brown and all these people that I had heard about, but now we're right there in touch. And these individuals, as well as NSA members, were just gifting everything. I couldn't believe how much people just gave of their knowledge, their skills, their abilities to try to help other people along their path. And so the BNSA for the Think and Grow Rich was really about maybe three years ago, was my first time going through the entire book, because I know that Anne was, you were doing something with it. And I think Marquesa kind of took up the ball and started running with it. And I decided to join the mastermind. And that's when I really first went through the book and said, oh my gosh, this is gold right here. This has nothing really to do with making money at all. If you look deep into it, this is about life, and because there are other categories that this can just go into way besides just making money. When I made that decision in 1994 to have my leg amputated, I can look back at that as a defining point of where I am now in revenue for making money. I wasn't thinking about making money when I lost a leg. But now I see that decision put me in a place where I can have impact, and that impact, there is a financial dollar attached to it now that I can point to. That had nothing to do with me trying to go out and go get it at that point in time, but it grew from that one decision that I made. And so for all the listeners that are out there right now, you can make the decision, and you don't have to make it around the finances and the money. Just make the decision, and those things will begin to come to you because you have been because you have made that decision to move forward in whatever aspect or area that you are in your life. And I'll shut up now, Ann.
No problem. We do have another caller. I really appreciate that. Just make the decision, and I would like to add, once you make the decision, the way will present itself. It's amazing how that happens. Okay, our caller, last four digits of your number is 3400, and we're going to go ahead and open your microphone. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Wyman Winbush calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Wive and Whippers.
Good morning, everyone on the panel. Good morning, John. Hey,
good
John,
morning.
I know you well, brother. And one of the things I'd like you to comment on, it's in one of the chapters of the book, Think and Grow Rich, but it is faith. Can you share with us briefly, I know you've alluded to it, but I want you to explicitly share with us how faith played a role in your transition, your accepting of the new normal, and you're exploiting the platform that God gave you, right, even though it seemed to be tragic. But as you know, all things work together for those who love the Lord. So could you share with us your thoughts on that for us?
Sure, yeah. Thanks for the question, Wyman. So for me, I was a I am a Christian and had been before I had the accident. So there was no kind of transition of me with inside of my faith except that the resolve to go deeper in it. In fact, on that day on the track was really a kind of a, it was a culmination of everything I was doing prior to that during all Army track and field camps, because I would have this all call. Anybody that wants to come can come to a Bible study. Right. And I just open it up every night. And folks would just kind of just come in, and if whoever came, I'd never force anybody. And we just have these kind of discussions around the Bible and different things, and, you know, just chatting. So when the injury actually happened, those that were pretty much the naysayers or call me the holy roller and all this stuff, the fascinating thing is that they were the very ones who were leading the hymns and songs on the track, because they knew who I was at that point in time and how I showed up in that time. Eyewitness account, because I don't remember this, but they said the first word out of my mouth was a scream, and I yelled it so loud was hallelujah. So how does that even happen, right? So so that was a total validation of who I was authentically in myself and that resolve. Now, I'm not saying that was I didn't have some doubts or I didn't have some things that were creeping in, because I did. But what it was like you're saying, Wyman, is that I knew that this was working out for my good, and I knew I had a hope with inside of that, and that could push me further on down the road. Hearing OJ, you know, about to check out, I knew that was not going to be a path for me, and that was totally designed on my faith. Because faith is, people think that faith is something that you can actually see, touch, feel, and you can, but it's in your future. It's what you can't see in the natural, because once it comes into your natural, then it's no longer faith to you, because it's you've experienced it. So now you have to grow in faith. You grow greater with inside of it. And I think that's what this book teaches, that once you have to have faith that that's going to happen, but once it comes into your existence, it's no longer faith. You have to expand your faith to actually believe something even greater is going to come on down the road. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you, man. Thank you so much. Thank all of the panel.
Absolutely.
This morning. Yes.
Oh, all right. Thank you so much for your question. And right now we're going to go to Galen, and I'm still on that just make the decision and the way will present itself. And it all is really in the spirit of faith, because that is the glue. So thank you, Wyman, for that question. All right, Galen, you're up.
Yes. Hey, man, this has been absolutely amazing. There are so many things I've gotten from this. And then one personal reinforcement that I'll share. Some of the things that I've gotten from your conversation is, number one, we have to control our own narrative. We have to control who we are. We have to control how we are represented in the world. And that's both on an individual basis as well as a group. Number two, I loved how you said we have to be prepared to amputate unhealthy relationships that don't see who we are now. They may be trying to hold on to who we used to be, but they're not ready to reinforce who we are now. So we've got to be prepared to amputate those unhealthy relationships. I love the imagery around the echo of vibration from the energy that we put into the world. And that's going to mess with me for a bit. But the one personal thing, and this is a personal story. My dad, as most fathers do when you're 13, 14, 15 years old, he used to say all these really kind of outlandish things that didn't make any sense. until you get much older. And one of the things he used to say is, you know, how he was a trailblazer in so many different avenues, and that he had to put up with a lot of things in corporate America. But the reason he put up with those things and the reason that he had tough conversations with power was so that if at some point his sons wanted to, or his daughter wanted to follow in his footsteps, they wouldn't have to fight the exact same battle. There might be other battles, mm-hmm. but they wouldn't have to fight the exact same battle. And he talked about the college that he went to. He was the first to enter that college as a freshman and graduate as a senior. There were others that were able to come in during his time later, you know, as a senior, but he was among the first class to come in as a freshman and graduate as a senior. And because of what he had to put up with, he was able to make it easier for those who might follow. That university that he went to was the University of Arkansas. And
wow.
Just to hear your story and to know that you've got roots at the University of Arkansas really made it personal for me that what we do, yeah, it's about us right here, right now, but we're also laying a future. We're laying the foundation of a legacy for those who will come behind us. So
absolutely.
Whether there is or whether there is not a payoff in our lifetime, I think for you, you are providing further evidence that my dad wasn't making all this stuff up, that what we do really does have an impact on the future. So thank you for that.
What's your father's name?
George Bingham. George Bingham.
George Bingham. I'm looking that name up. Yeah, we are living. I think that's, you know, I think for Wyman's comments, because I shifted another shift in my life. And I'm going to be totally transparent here. You know, there's still things I procrastinate on, and there's some triggers. I want to talk about the triggers that we have to recognize when we're going into that box of procrastination to kind of turn our way out of it. But the thing I wanted to share is that we are all leaving these legacies. And I had to learn that. I went through a class. It was a veterans entrepreneurship class. And I was just kind of there just being in awe of all these amazing people. And then there's a woman who asked the question, they'll say, what's the most important thing about business, you know, of your business? And we all had the wrong answer. And then she said, the most important thing about your business and building your business is how are you going to dispose of your business? And when I thought about that, I was like, wow, because that means you've been successful all the way through. And now you're just talking about how you're going to wrap it up. Are you going to put it on the stock market? Are you going to put it privately trade it? You know, you're going to leave it to as a legacy for your children, or, you know, so that begins to how you set everything else up for how you're going to leave it. So then I took that one step further and I said, well, what then do I want my life? What do I want to hear at the end of life? You know? And so for me, I wanted to hear my master say, well done, my good and faithful servant, enter into joy of my rest. And that shifted everything for me of what I want to do and how I want to show up in every area of my life. Because it changes every decision I make from that point forward. Everything is run through with that lens. And so I'm more dedicated and resolved in that than just living from like this day-to-day existence, because I want to hear those words at the end of my life. And that shifts me. So legacy is huge.
Well, John, I can't speak for God, but I tell you what, I can speak for myself and many of our friends whose lives you have touched and changed. Because when you look at Lex, and thank you so very much for bringing him into the mastermind.
Love
he is
guy.
A joy.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And for those of you that don't know Lex, Lex is one of the individuals that, and John, you can tell his story, but I just want to say that he's in our mastermind group. And for those who may not be aware, we talked about the mastermind with Black NSA, and we come on a Monday evening, and you can get the details, you know, go to Google or go to Black NSA, And you can, the website, you can get the details. But John invited Lex to be a part of our mastermind. And what I loved about Lex, some of the lives that you've touched and changed, and it's been the lives, it's the domino effect. Like we talked about Galen's dad and the domino effect and how you're able to benefit, and then the lives you're touching to have God tell you good and faithful servant, well done. But what I was so amazing to me about Lex is we're on a Zoom, as some of you know, and we start out, say, with 20, 30, 40, 50 people, whatever the number is, and we break off into small groups. And because I am coaching through different groups, they move me. I don't know when they're going to move me, but there's no sound, there's no movement, there's nothing. Lex is blind. And every time I get in their group, he calls me out. He said, well, Miss Ann is here, or Miss McNeil is here. And I'm saying to myself, how does he know? But it goes to the point you're exactly. It goes to the point you're making. The other people that with sight, they can't see that I show up and they keep talking. But Lex says, Ann is here.
Right.
So, you know, I know we can go until tomorrow on the show, and we're going to have to wrap it up. But I want to find out from our other hosts if they have any additional comments before we go to John and ask him to give us his closing comments, because you have been a phenomenal guest, a phenomenal friend, and you're doing some phenomenal things in the world. And this is, you know, you're the first person I ever heard talk about the new normal. Now, everybody's talking about the new normal. I say, no, y'all got that from John Register. So, John, we're going to ask our Galen and Earth if you have any additional comments before we wrap up and go to John.
This is Ursula. There is just one thing I want to say in terms of aha. When, John, you talked about you have to define who you are, it reminded me of how I used to struggle with one particular person that every time I did something, she would say, oh, that's because you're technical. And I resisted that because, yes, I am technical, but I also felt like I was creative, but she just didn't know that side of me. And when I wrote my first book, she was dumbfounded. But now as I listen to the conversation, especially in the last 10 minutes or so, I realized that that technical and that creative side have come together for the good of telling the stories of Mr. Bingham and Mr. Register and Ms. McNeil. And my latest form is by virtue of a legacy wall. And on that wall, the last one that I did highlighted the people that are no longer here, the people that dedicated their lives to that particular organization, and the people that have come through there that are still alive. Now, the importance of that for me was when I saw, standing beneath the word, because it was above this child's head, it was taller than he, because it was a 20 by 30 foot wall, and the visual was the back of a child's head looking at a trailblazer who was the first African-American electrical contractor in the state of Florida, looking directly at him because his eyes were looking directly at the camera, so it looked like that person was looking at this child. And above his head were the words, you can do it. And so that is the foundation that is created by the people that we've talked about today that is relevant to the people that need it to carry it into the future. So you all were a great setup for what I love doing, bringing that together for the good of the future.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. And Galen, you're up.
Yeah. So just finally, you know, as I was listening again to your entire conversation, I'm reminded of scripture where we understand how God feels about us not using and investing our talents. And so I just want to thank you for investing your talent, regardless of the immediate payout. The world needs your talent, and you're giving courage and you're giving confidence to others that they too can invest their talents, and that's really what they are here to do. So thank you for that.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Galen and Ursula. Now, John, if you have any closing comments before we wrap up this awesome show, and tell us how to reach you. Thank you.
And how to what?
how to reach you. Just let everybody know how to reach you, and if you have any special programs. But I'd like to say before you start, I was sharing with our host as we were preparing for the show this morning that Les Brown, who's been a friend, gosh, for over 35, almost 40 years, many people like to just call his phone to listen to his voicemail message. And I was saying to Ursula and Gail, I said, let's call John Register's phone so we can hear his awesome message. And then you picked up. So make sure you give everybody a way to reach you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Okay, so I love this chapter on decisions. It's one of the toughest chapters for me because even though I talked about, you know, the amputation and making that decision pretty quickly, it was within minutes. There are other things that I still procrastinate on. So I don't want anybody to get the understanding that, you know, I've licked this thing because I have not. And there's still things that I procrastinate on. One of which is, I think in the space of where I am, there has been places, for example, when I decided to leave the United States Olympic Committee, I think I stayed on too long. I think I was supposed to leave a little bit earlier. But, you know, God had to kick me out of there on January 4th. So off of my own because of the impact I believe that I was to make in the world. You know, comfort kept me there, and so I procrastinated. So what are the things that keep you in your space? Is it comfort, inconvenience, or are you anxious about outcomes or uncertainty about your future? So and part of the uncertainty in my – not really uncertainty in my future, but what I procrastinate also is I'm building out underneath me, like you mentioned, Lex Ann, is my own Inspired Communications International Speakers Bureau. And I'm training those individuals up so they can have robust conversations, because I think that's what speakers do, is create the dialogue for others to release themselves to be better in their own worlds. And it's a daunting task. But remember, it's doable through, you know, the poem, See It Through. When you're up against a trouble, meet it squarely face to face. Lift your chin, set your shoulders, plant your feet, and take a brace. When it's vain to try to dodge it, do the best that you can do. You may fail, but you may conquer. See it through. So you got to see it through to the end, and that's that dogged determination. And then finally, you know, we talked about those R's. I want all your R words that you wrote down for me, because when you see my name, it's J-R, and that R is critical in the name, not just register, but it's the, you know, what are we resisting? What are we reaching back on? What are we rebuilding? What's our resilience? What are we reading? All those R words are part of that, of my whole spiel of what makes me up. What's our ritual that elevates us to puts us into our rhythm, that elevates us to our rise? The resilience that's in our lives, all those things are beginning with those R's, and I try to make a whole list of those out. So I ask you right now to the audience, you know, what are you resisting? Because that's a really great indicator on what you need to make a decision on and be determined to move past. Or what do you resist? Or why do you resist it? And then what decisions can you make today? Or actually not even today. Let's say tomorrow before 10 o'clock, the one thing that you're resisting, what can you do to eliminate it, move it out of your way, to amputate it? How can you do it? What will you do tomorrow by 10 o'clock, tomorrow, Sunday morning, that you're going to amputate to get rid of that resistance? And you need to write it down and get yourself an accountability partner, a mastermind, so to speak, to make sure that you are holding you accountable to it. And you can't just get anybody. You got to get somebody that can see it with you. Or see it beyond and see beyond what you see, and not someone that's going to hold you back. And how to reach me, you can go on johnregister.com, and I want to pull a Donna St. Louis on this, that if you're listening and you want to just chat with me, you can chat me up at 719-357-6833, and the reason I put that out there like that is because as Donna St. Louis does this all the time, one of our, you know, in our great intersayers, no one calls because they don't think they're serious, and I'm the only one that calls her, and she says, I got 3 hours free, call me, and no one calls her. I'm saying, call. Just pick up the phone and call, and I'll answer the phone if I'm in a place where I can actually answer it. So and we can have a chat.
And if he doesn't answer, he will definitely call you back. I am a witness.
I'll call you back.
Yes, he will. Thank you, everybody, for chiming in. We've had an awesome guest, an awesome time talking about the decision chapter. Join us next week. We will continue the dialogue with another special guest. And also, before we wrap up, always want to remember to invite everybody to our Think and Grow Rich annual accountability meeting, a day of goal setting and accountability on January the 4th, 2020. That's a Saturday at 8 a.m. We will be at the Embassy Suites by Hilton in Boca Raton, Florida. And you can go to Eventbrite and just search Think and Grow Rich annual accountability or Masterminders, and you will find the details. But, John, you have been a joy with all of the R's, and so we're going to put the J for joy. Thank you, everybody,
for
listening, and we will see you next week on the radio. Have a good one. This is Ann McNeil, the Master Builder, Building Stronger and Better Lives, signing off. Thank you.
For more information about the International Mastermind Association, visit internationalmasterminders.com or on Facebook, visit the group International Mastermind Association. The name of the book is Think and Grow Rich, the original version restored and revised by Napoleon Hill. ISBN 1-593-302002. That ISBN number again, 1-593-302002.